Hello and welcome to this 96th episode of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Chris Shunt, and today I will be joined by fellow autobloggers Dan Roth and Sam Abul Samad. What's going on, guys?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey. How you doing?
Once again, we've got the B team rolling in effect, as some of you call us the A team, which is cool as well. We've once again assembled the team, and more importantly, we're now stringing together a third consecutive podcast without a break. How about that, Dan?
That's not too bad.
3 weeks in a row? What's wrong with this picture?
If we get to a month, it's going to be a record.
Probably will be, because it's like, wow, the site's how old, and then we've got 96 podcasts.
I think they did four in a row one time.
Yeah, I think the most is probably four or five. I forget.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get on to what we want to talk about.
You know, we always go through the Autoblog garage first, and we usually go with Sam, but today I'm interested in what Dan drove this week.
Kia Sedona EX.
Oh, you lucky guy. How'd you manage to score that one?
They like me. You know what? My kids love it. Well, I mean, the six-week-old doesn't care. He sleeps. But the two-and-a-half-year-old daughter loved it. The second-row captain's chairs and the windows that would go down. And she actually said, you know, this is great, Daddy. So...
Well, you know what? Kids always love vans. Vans and, like, big crossovers and stuff like that, where they have room to climb around, and, you know, it's like a giant playroom on wheels.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you're driving around with sunglasses on, and the sun's not even out because you're embarrassed. You'd be in a minivan.
You know what? That's a nice van. I mean, it's got that. Their 3.8 liter V6 is awesome. That's going to do really well once it hits the Genesis. It sounds great. It's got tons of power.
The 3.3 or the 3.8?
The 3.8.
Okay.
And the EX itself is the long wheelbase, and it had like the powered doors. I mean, it was loaded. It's a huge vehicle, but it drives like a car. So, you know, yeah, it's a van and it comes with that stigma, but for a family, it's really tough to beat a van, and it's exceptionally difficult to beat the Kia vans. They're a huge deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, Kia's got the reputation of having, you know, good value for dollar. The first generation Sedona, though, you know, that one was kind of criticized for being kind of heavy and, you know, not that exceptional looking, and, you know, didn't handle very well. How's this one compare, you know, from the driving standpoint?
I'm sure it's probably about as heavy, but it, for its size, it handles quite well. Actually, it's actually, you know, I was clipping apexes with it today just for giggles. Because you got to do something.
Giggles or frights?
Yeah, it's obvious that you don't get the same kind of giggles I do.
Hey, you make your giggles where you can.
I guess so.
Who's that short guy doing figure eights in the Sedona?
How's it doing on gas?
You know, I didn't have a chance to really reset the odometer. I will say that it probably got about 350 miles on a tank, and the tank itself, I filled it up today. The tank itself was under 18 gallons that I put in, so
Well, that's not too shabby.
I mean, it's just
under 20 miles per gallon.
Yeah, I mean, it's not great. It's probably, I would expect it to be like 21, if I could stop wailing on it. The engine sounds great at like 3,500 and above, so I'd get on the highway and just put the transmission over in manual mode and pin it to the floor for a little while. So if you didn't do that,
you wouldn't be an auto blogger, though.
right, and it's a great powertrain. Too bad it's wrapped in a van. You know, the enthusiast in me cries. But I would be surprised if you could really eke out more than about 25 on the highway, being very gentle.
That'll be tough, because almost no van gets that with the amount of power.
It's a big vehicle. It does have a 5-speed automatic. But, I doubt that with the amount of horsepower it has, it would get much better than 25.
All right, I have to cut you short, Dan, because if we go over 3 minutes and 30 seconds on a minivan, then we get fired. So
I babble.
Yeah. Next, we've got Sam. Sam, what'd you have this week?
I managed to score a Saab Turbo X, which Dan is quite familiar with, having just been to the media drive a couple weeks ago. Got a call last Wednesday. They had to cancel the Saturn Outlook I was supposed to get, And he said, so you want a Saab Turbo X instead? And I said, yeah, okay, sure. No problem.
How do you manage that as a transition, for crying out loud?
I don't know. They called me, and I said, yeah, okay. And, you know, there it was the next morning. So
you know how Sam gets that stuff? He's on Larry Burns' speed dial. So, I mean, he knows everybody at GM. I mean, everybody's like, hey, it's Sam. And then they just go on about their day. So, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, just Saabs just show up in the Abel of Sam at garage.
So, no, the question is, was I full of beans on my first drive impressions or pretty much?
Actually, I think you're pretty close. I mean, the one that they sent me has the automatic transmission, unfortunately, rather than the manual. But it after I got to know it and figure out how to get the best out of it, it's actually not too bad. It's a 6-speed automatic, and it's got thumb toggles on the steering wheel spokes that you can manually shift it. Mm-hmm. Which I used liberally on a trip this weekend down to Yellow Springs, Ohio. But I also found that if you use the sport shift button on the dash, it does make a huge difference in the way it behaves just in normal driving around in automatic mode. It shifts much more aggressively. When you leave it in just the normal default mode, really, I think, you know, for a car like this, the sport shift mode should be the default mode when you turn the car on. And then instead of a sport button, there should be a comfort button.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So the comfort, you know, the normal mode, you know, the shifts are a little bit smoother, but it also saps some of the joy out of this car, you know, which, you know, kind of defeats the purpose of it. As soon as you start the car, immediately put it into sport shift mode. And then, you know, if you want to, you know, put it into manual mode. And I found that I ended up using the manual mode on the trip to Ohio because it turns out that between 2,000 and 2,400 RPM, the exhaust note in this thing has a real nasty drone sound. It's very unpleasant. And it just so happens that 70 miles an hour in sixth gear equates to about 2,100 RPM, which puts it right in the heart of that drone zone.
That's bad planning right there.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, I just popped it into manual and dropped it down to fifth gear, which, you know, made it use a little bit more fuel, but it pushed the speed up to 2,500 RPM, and it was nice quiet cruise. I mean, the seats, you know, as usual in a Saab are just outstanding, you know, really comfortable for a long trip. And the one other thing that I found kind of odd was the fuel tank seems to be kind of small in this thing. It's only about a 14-gallon tank. I ended up having to fill it up when I got down to Ohio.
That was one of the specific questions was they actually had to make a new tank for the Turbo X because of where the Haldex unit is in back.
Okay. So they had to go to a smaller tank?
No, it didn't lose any capacity. I think it is probably about a 15-gallon tank, but, you know, by the time you got a gallon in there, it's reading empty anyway. But it's like a saddle tank now, and we didn't notice the drone because all we heard was tires screaming at the media drive. We torched a lot of Pirellis that day, and we didn't notice anything about fuel mileage because we were there to just beat them. So
I took a look at the tires on this one when it arrived, and I suspect that this car was one of the ones that was part of the media ride that you were on, because even though there were only like 430 miles on the clock, the tires looked pretty heavily worn. So
yeah, especially edges, right?
I think this car came direct to Detroit from where was it, in Boston?
In Boston, they had they did 2 days in Boston. So
It had 400 miles on it, but probably looked like about 4,000, 5,000 miles of driving wear on the tires.
Hey, Dan, when you had your media event, did they talk about having any new applications, new vehicles for that 2.8 turbo combo? Because it seems like a pretty sweet combination from reading what you wrote.
The LP9 is awesome, and that's GM's designation for it. It's the high feature V6 with the turbo on it, and I think right now all Epsilon development is being done by GM Powertrain Europe, which is really Saab and Opel and the others. But I think
Vauxhall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Saab takes the lead on that 2.8.
Yeah, I think so as well. And they didn't say anything about the engine itself, but they did mention that the rest of the hardware, the Haldex 4.0, I believe it is, hardware, is going to trickle down to other Epsilons. But, the key to that car is the integration and the program, because it is just an Epsilon. It's not a new car. And, you know, that is just the high-feature V6. But together, it's more than the sum of its parts. And it's a very sweet car. You know, the engine is really surprising. I mean, it's 2.8 liters, and it has 280 horsepower. You know, that's BMW territory right there. That's 100 horsepower per liter.
Yeah, there is a little bit of turbo lag, at least in the automatic. You know, when you first step into it, if you're just kind of cruising and you step into it to go to pass somebody, for example, there's a little bit of a lag before, you know, if you watch the boost gauge, the boost gauge jumps up, and then you start to feel some real thrust. But, you know, if you were driving it in manual mode, and you had the revs running higher, or if you had a manual transmission car, you could probably get around that pretty easily. You could keep it into the heart of the power band, you know, so you don't have any lag. But with the automatic in auto mode, and the other thing I noticed too, if you put the automatic in sport shift mode, when you're decelerating, you can feel it downshifting, just like, you know, if you're doing it with a manual transmission, which is really nice.
Yeah, no, it's a heck of a car.
Dan, did you have the chance to use the manual?
Yeah, we had both. You know, the manual is really for driving enjoyment. That's the one to get. It's got a nice shifter action. It's not real sloppy. I think it performs better. The auto trans, you know, I mean, we were doing an autocross kind of thing with it. So you're in the middle of a corner and you're trying to go slow in, fast out. That the auto is a little dopey unless you use manual mode. You know, I went around the course with it in regular mode just to see what it would do. And, you know, coming out of corners, it wasn't giving me the gear I needed until I was already on the straights. So the manual is really the one to have. You can heel toe it really nicely. And, you know, all the things that nobody but auto geeks do on the street. The auto, though, again, in normal driving, perfectly acceptable. It's well matched to the turbo. You know, overall, I can't complain about that car. You know, if I had the requisite 40-something grand, it would certainly be on my list to drive.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would really change, the two things I would change would be the exhaust system, because it really is annoying in that 2,000 to 2,400 RPM range. And unfortunately, there's a lot of cars these days that have that kind of droning exhaust sound, and it really drives me nuts. But that, and, you know, I would make the sport shift mode the default when you turn on the car and switch the label on the button to a comfort button.
Yeah, see, and you could probably actually do that. The rest of us would just complain.
Yeah, it wouldn't be that hard to do.
So, all right. What are you driving, Shunk Master Flex?
I just got a 2009 Mercury Mariner Hybrid.
Who?
The 2009 Mercury Mariner Hybrid.
That's the Ford with the vertical bar grille.
Oh, the Ford. I got it.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's so far so good. It's extremely impressive. You know, Sam and I, the only time I ever drove in the Escape Hybrid, Sam was with me in the car, and we were at the Ford event last year, and I don't know if you remember that, Sam, but we went through there, and it was nice enough, but the new 2.5 is a much smoother application for the hybrid powertrain. It was, you know what? So far, so good. And I've only had it for a day, but I've already driven it 80 miles. So I mean, I really got my money's worth out of the first day. But everything, the travel link, with the travel link navigation, very cool. I think I was amazed at the amount of room for the second row. I'd never driven an Escape with the kids in the back. I just kind of assumed that there wasn't enough room for all three of my kids to sit in the back seat, because, you know, I thought it would be more narrow, but I don't think there's any less room there is than the Freestyle that we have now. So overall, my impression so far, pretty good.
Yeah, we had our Escape Love Fest last week, or the last time we all were together, so.
Yeah, I think the back seat of the Escape is a little on the narrow side if you compare it to, say, the Saturn View. you know, which is it's just a little bit longer wheelbase than the Escape. And if you look at the back seat, the Escape back seat and the Escape and Mariner back seat actually sits between the wheel wells, whereas in the View it sits ahead of the wheel well. So you do have a little more hip room in the View,
but you have less load room.
The View is a little bit longer as well.
I thought the roofline cut into the interior volume.
The view is just a bigger
not in the
vehicle.
Back seat. Yeah,
the View is pretty much a bigger vehicle in every way, and it weighs about 600 pounds more than the Escape. So, yes. I mean, that's not chicken feed, right? That's a lot of weight. So,
well, the two wheel drive View is not that much heavier than the Escape. It's only about 400 pounds.
That's me and Dan is 400 pounds.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
I'd call that some poundage. But, so far so good. I'll probably have a lot better gauge on it by next week, since I'll have it for a week by then.
I did drive an Escape Hybrid and was really impressed with it. And this is just the 2.3. So I have really good things to say about that vehicle. I like it in all its forms. So
the one thing that I did that I just got a kick out of was when I'm driving like 18, 20 miles an hour, I could go in EV mode only. Yep. And when it kicks, and when, you know, everybody always say, I've heard Sam say it in the past, you know, it's the seamless transition to gasoline power. And it literally is absolutely seamless. Once you're in the car and you've done it four or five times, you don't even feel it. I mean, you have to look down at the RPM gauge just to know when the engine kicks in, because you can't tell otherwise.
The difference between the 08 and the 09 there, I mean, they did a great job. I mean, it's all software calibrations there, just in the way they control the powertrain. And the difference from 08 to 09 is really striking, especially if you drive them back-to-back. And you obviously haven't had a chance to do that. But it's a huge improvement for the 09s. And I think, you know, really, if you're looking for a compact crossover with really good fuel economy, you can't do any better than the Escape Hybrid.
Well, it's impressive that it's really aggressive about jumping into EV mode. It does it as much as it possibly can, and I was really surprised. It stays in EV mode up to, you know, almost 30 miles an hour.
For the 09s, if you have sufficient charge in the battery, it can stay in EV mode up to 40 miles an hour now.
Oh, that's awesome!
Wow.
Yeah,
so I have to get the.
It used to be 25, and they bumped it to 40 for the 09s.
Nice.
How do you get the charge up besides braking?
That's downhill. It. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it just depends on, you know, when you back off the throttle, you know, and just do some regen braking, just let it coast.
Yeah, don't drive it like a Kia minivan.
Yeah. No figure eight for me, okay.
Or the way I drive just about anything.
All right.
Yeah, Sam's got a left foot. All right, let's go to the news. We had a few interesting stories this week. We'll lead it off with the CTS wagon that... we had some spy shots of, and actually the picture of the CTS wagon that we'd gotten from a Jalopnik reader actually got pulled because the Cadillac folks didn't want us to keep it on there, but a lot of information. It was from a survey. I can't remember what it was, a Harris Opinion survey, and had a lot of information, including information about the powertrains. A 3-liter V6 will be coming with 260 horsepower. And that will replace the non-direct inject 3.6, and then the 304 horsepower 3.6 liter will be the second powertrain. And I don't know, Sam or Dan, did you guys see
it? Is that 3-liter going to be a DI?
I would believe so. It must really be really tough to get 260 horsepower without direct injection.
Yeah. So that would make sense. I mean, that
yes,
that's
it is.
Something
I just read
I'm kind of surprised. I'm kind of surprised that they didn't do that right off the bat this year when they introduced the direct inject 3.6. You know, is just drop the base 3.6 and just go with, you know, either the 2.8, you know, which they already have in Europe in the European applications with direct injection, which would be pretty close to that, you know, or do this 3-liter. But that makes sense for them to do that, because that'll buy them, you know, a couple miles per gallon right there, compared to the current base 3.6.
Right. Yeah. I think that since the 3-liter is an absolutely brand new engine, there's no other application in the GM lineup that there is a 3-liter V6. I would say that they probably just finished development on it and it's on its way.
Well, is that, is it a new engine, or is it just a version of the high feature?
You outlaw, I think, it could be dis, stroked out differently or whatever, but it, as a 3-liter, there is no 3-liter in the lineup right now.
Right, so maybe right. It's the pretty close to the 2.8 with a little bit more stroke for some more torque without turbocharging, you know, it's...
Right, I think, I think that's probably what it is, because that, the high feature, you know, the 3.6, 2.8 liter family is a fairly new engine. That's only been around for a few years, and I don't think that they would do a brand new engine right. At this point in time, based on that. So I'm sure it's just a different variation of that engine.
And it still needs to be carefully tested and checked. So
right. Yeah, absolutely. It's not something they could just throw out there. I mean, I think the 3.6 came out in 2004. And yeah, that was just on the Cadillac CTS. And the 2.8, if you remember, the 2.8 was the base engine for the CTS for a while. And then it disappeared. And then it was just the 3.6. So
I don't think the 2.8 was ever in the CTS.
It was. It was the base engine. And it was 210 horsepower. And it was the only model you can get for $32,000 was the 2.8 liter. And it didn't sell very well. So it was in there for sure.
I don't even ever remember it even being offered in there, but... I'll take your word for it.
Right. And then with the 3.6 or the 3-liter, what interests me was, I don't think the Malibu gets all that great fuel economy, but the Malibu and Aura should almost for sure get the 3-liter V6 instead if it's the same power. And right now they're saying on the CTS wagon, 27 miles per gallon, which is better than what they're getting with the Malibu right now with the 3.6.
Yeah. I'm sure... We'll see that in the Malibu. We'll probably first see it in the Aura next year, because they'll probably introduce a new Aura based on the new Opel Insignia that's coming out this year in Europe. So they'll probably launch the Aura here next year with that engine in there, and then drop it into the Malibu.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that are going to affect fuel economy in the Malibu application versus the CTS. You know, the CTS is rear-wheel drive, and, you know, there's I'm looking at the post now. There's no talk about transmissions or final drive. So, I mean, you could make them get 30 miles to the gallon, but they're going to have a, you know, 2.7-something to 1 rear end and 6-speed autos that jump for high at you know, the whiff of the throttle. So, it'll be interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens, especially with everybody complaining about gas prices, which they should stay high, in my opinion. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with the next generation of vehicles from everybody, whether they go for economy or performance, or try to do both.
They have to be able to tune it two different ways, just so you can satisfy both. And Sam knows you could do a lot of stuff with software, and you've seen it.
Absolutely.
So I mean, there's like. For instance, the EcoBoost from Ford, I mean, that's basically, if they change the software around, they can probably turn it into a performance application. But right now, I'm sure it's built strictly for improved miles per gallon.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that's going to be interesting to watch with the CTS wagon is just how many of the wagons they actually managed to sell in the U.S. market. Because the U.S. market, you know, has not been... particularly fond of wagons in recent years for whatever reason. I don't understand why Americans are so averse to wagons, because
wagons are awesome.
I love them. I mean, you know, we've got one in my garage. You know, that's what my wife drives, and, you know, go on road trips. I mean, that's the best way to go.
Yeah.
I'd much rather, you know, take a standard, you know, station wagon than an SUV.
Yeah. Well, you know, the wagons turn and stop, and you use moderate amounts of fuel, and
yeah,
right. And if they could, I think a lot of the wagons that are on the market right now are not exactly fuel efficient. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Subaru or the Volvo. Neither one of them get stellar fuel economy. But if this CTS wagon can pull 27 miles per gallon and cost $37,500, like they say it's going to, then that'll be a little bit more of a compelling argument than 17 miles per gallon combined. For the Volvo, and in the Volvo, on top of that, is, I think the model I had was $45,000. Dan, how much was the one that you had?
The one that I had was like 37, I think. But I had a 2-wheel drive. See, now that's the thing, you got to be careful with the Volvos. They push their cross country line a lot, and those, I mean, there's a lot of extra weight and and yeah, friction. The two-wheel drive wagons can actually do pretty well. I mean, I have a Volvo, and it routinely pushes 26.5.
But the wagon you got only got 19.
The S80 only got 19, which is pretty close, I guess, to the V70. I got about 21, 22 with the two-wheel drive wagon.
And I got
with the V70?
18. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris, you had the XC70, right, Chris?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had one of those recently, too, and it was pretty thirsty. We've got a V70 coming this weekend, so I'll get a better chance. And, you know, the V70 is almost 500 pounds lighter than the XC70.
Yeah. That's significant.
Yeah. You know, but that new 6, the 3.2-liter inline 6 that Volvo developed, it's very cleverly packaged, but it's no more fuel-efficient than the inline 5s were. Even the turbocharged inline 5s, the LPT and high-pressure turbo units, which is kind of surprising because it's, you know, it makes as much horsepower and torque, I believe, as the turbocharged units do, at least the light pressure units. So you'd expect, you know, with a little bit more power, just without any kind of forced induction, it would get better mileage, but it doesn't. So
I think this is a totally different subject for a different day, but I think Volvo, if they're going to stay part of the Ford family, they're going to need to use the Ford engines because they can't afford to keep having their own powertrains. It just doesn't make any sense.
I got two letters for
volume there.
Two characters for them. D5. That's the engine that should be coming to the U.S. for their vehicles.
D5?
Yeah. That's their diesel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, they offer that one in the, I think, in the Mondeo and the Focus in Europe.
Yeah.
Okay, the next story we have is probably one of the more humorous and ridiculous of the week, and basically it's Hyundai was claiming that their new hybrid system, which nobody has actually, you know, seen on the street, is far more advanced than the Prius, which has been around since I was in college. So, you know, basically they're saying, and they're comparing it to what Toyota has on the street now versus what nobody has seen from Hyundai, and of course, you know, by the time their product comes out, then we're going to have a new Prius. So, Sam, obviously you're Autoblog Green, and what do you think?
I'll believe it when I see it. And, you know, I know Hyundai's been working on their own in-house hybrid designs and their own hydrogen fuel cells in Korea. You know, they've got a few hundred, I think, Elantras. Hybrid Elantra is running around in Korean government fleets over there. But, you know, Toyota's got a third-generation Prius coming next January at the Detroit Auto Show. And I'm sure they'll have some surprises up their sleeve. Although, you know, who knows? I mean, they might not. I mean, it might just be a refinement of what they have today. So we'll see what happens come 2010, you know, when Hyundai actually brings something to market over here.
Well, you know, talk is cheap, too. I mean, it's interesting to see him say, you know, oh, the Prius is now quite old tech. Well, yeah, of course, the one that's for sale is not the one that's in development. So it'll be interesting to see their bluff get called. And it'll be great if they have something that's that much more efficient.
Well, it's beautiful for Toyota because they don't have to say a word because they know people like us are going to just laugh it off. Because, I mean, think about it. If they even generate a response, then that would show that they're at least slightly worried about Hyundai. But I'm in the big scheme of things, Toyota's, at least perception-wise, so far above and beyond the rest of the automakers, at least in the U.S., that, I mean, Hyundai's saying, oh, you know, just wait 2 years from now, we're going to come back and kick your butt. It doesn't hold a lot of water.
Well, then again, you know, if you look at what Hyundai has done recently, you know, with cars like the Genesis and the Genesis Coupe, you know, you got to think, well, you know, that maybe they've got something up their sleeve. I mean, who knows? I wouldn't put it past them to come up with something, you know, really original. You know, we'll have to wait and see.
I think it's going to be really tough to beat the Prius at its own game unless they've discovered, you know, cold fusion or something. I mean, the Prius has not been stagnant since 1997. You know, they developed that car fastidiously. So,
although the powertrain hasn't really changed much since 1997 either. I mean, it's still largely the same.
But the software is different. You know,
they've refined it. You know, cost reduced it and everything, but. You know, it's the basic technology hasn't changed dramatically in the last 10 years.
What I found interesting about the Prius is that the engine's actually growing. That was the sort of thing that I didn't expect to see from Toyota, and it seems like they're growing their powertrains across the lineup. The 2.5s now the 2.7, they're the, was it a 2.4 is now the 2.7 and the SUVs, and now this, the 1.5 is going to be a 1.8 now, and while everybody else is retreating on their size, they're kind of growing a little bit to kind of meet them halfway.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to wait and see what Toyota comes up with in January, because they made a big deal about that at this year's Detroit Auto Show, announcing that next year they will be introducing two brand new dedicated hybrid vehicles at the Detroit show. So
Dan,
one will be a Lexus and one will be the Prius.
Dan, I know you don't typically travel for the auto shows, but I think this Detroit show in 2009 is one you might have to find some time for. Because, I mean, just from what we're hearing early on, this is going to be a lot like 2007 and be a big year. So I'm looking forward to it. And you know what? I hope Hyundai's right. I hope they have this fantastic thing. But like you said, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it'd be great if they do, but I'm skeptical.
The more the merrier.
Absolutely. Because then competition breeds better things for us, right? All right. Speaking of fuel...
well said.
I kind of tripped over that one, didn't I? But speaking of fuel economy, we've got the Dodge Ram in the news this week with its fuel economy claims of 20% improvement, which, I mean, look, the truck market can use every little bit of help it can, and 20% fuel efficiency improvement, and then at the same time bumping the power to 380 horsepower. I mean, it sounds like a win-win. I mean, obviously, we haven't seen it in real life, but 23 mile per gallon trucks, that's pretty decent.
Yeah, especially considering that's not even their hybrid version yet. That's not coming until 2010. They did announce last year after they brought out the revamped version of their 4.7 liter V8. At that time, you were there, Chris, Chelsea, yeah, when they did their preview of the 2008 models. Frank Clegan did a presentation, and he said, For this year, they were completely revamping the Hemi, the 5.7 liter Hemi, and that's what they've done for the new Rams. So they've gone back and it's got new heads, new cams, new engine management software. It's basically practically been redesigned within the same basic architecture.
That's pretty impressive, though. 20% gain in highway economy due mainly to aerodynamics, from what they're claiming.
It lost 80 pounds.
Yeah, 80 pounds, though, at highway speeds? I mean, that's really a question of
stasis. That weight doesn't really make any difference.
I was going to keep going, but you kind of stopped me there.
we had to jump on you.
they also were, didn't they go to leaf springs for the back?
And that's kind of, coils.
Coils, yeah. So it's a single-stage coil, and it's different than any truck on the market right now, at least the full-size trucks that I can think of.
Yeah, it's the only full size pickup truck with coil spring rear suspension. Everybody else still uses leaf spring setups for the big trucks. Although the full size SUVs in recent years have switched from leaf spring to coil spring setups as well, but this is definitely the first pickup truck to go that route. But again, that's not one of the things that's really going to affect the fuel economy. The fuel economy is going to be the aerodynamics and the powertrain, and the new Ram is definitely a lot sleeker than the big blunt nose on the last generation model.
And it looks better too. That's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
It looks awesome.
Yeah, the Ram is going to be a real contender. I mean, it's like fighting for last place. Because the truck market is so bleak right now. But it looks like a real player, and it looks better than pretty much anything else out there.
Well, that's the problem, as you say. It's a strong contender, but in a shrinking market segment, a very rapidly shrinking segment. It's following the SUVs right down the toilet. A lot of the pickup trucks are sold for commercial use as opposed to SUVs, which are more for consumer use. And with the collapse of the real estate market and everything, a lot of contractors aren't buying new trucks. So it's going to be interesting to see how they fare over the coming year, both Chrysler and Ford.
So look for big rebates on the new Hemi, which is 20% more efficient on the highway.
Yeah. Give them about a week after they hit the dealerships, yeah, you know, before the $5,000 cash rebates. A
pile of cash on the hood.
My favorite now is that you see all these guys with pickup trucks and they've got their bed, you know, the bed door open, thinking that they're going to get more, you know, aerodynamics and they're going to get better fuel economy. And it's like you guys are really pulling right now because you're not getting anything extra.
Yeah, it makes no difference.
Right. Actually, we're still on trucks. Ford, via Motor Trend, was talking about the F100 and Global Ranger replacement. Obviously, Ford's thinking smaller for trucks, first with the F100, which basically is going to be a 9/10 scale F-150, you know, less weight. It's going to have V6 and four-cylinder powertrains, just basically from what Motor Trend says anyway. And then with regards to the Ranger, obviously they sell the smaller trucks around the world, and they've got nicer trucks in places like India right now, but they will have the ability to bring it here, which would be a real treat.
Well, their Ranger that they have elsewhere is, again, it's a much... to me, it looks much better than the Ranger we've got now, which has been updated a couple of times in its lifetime, but it's the same essential architecture that debuted in, 84 with the original Ranger. The one good thing about all of these very high energy prices is that it's going to breathe some life into the Ranger program, which was pretty much dead, unfortunately, because that's the
The Ranger's been dead in the water for 10 years.
Which is a damn shame, because it's a nice truck. It's so antique. It's very quaint. And, there's no way I'm going to go spend $25,000 on a Ranger.
The whole Ranger disaster, and it really was a debacle, that when I was in college here in Michigan, the vehicle of choice for guys like me, half my friends had Ford Rangers. Literally,
the
half.
Ranger Splash.
I had the those weren't my kind of friends, but we had the Rangers, and you'd get some flare sides in there, but a lot of them 4x4s and a lot of black, So they were the cool truck, and I went the other way and I got a Sonoma, but which I thought was pretty cool, and I had a mid 90s Sonoma, which I liked a lot, but that was it. And a lot of the guys that bought those, I still hang out with today, and half of those guys have F-150s. And that's where I think the real shame was, in that I think there was no place for you to go if you didn't need, want, or couldn't afford an F-150. Your choice was to get a really cheap F-150 when rebates come out, and then, the next thing you know, you're getting 15 miles per gallon for the rest of your life. So, yeah. The Ranger was a sweet, sweet product just, literally 10 years ago, and then it just dropped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, it was awesome back in 95. It's still a nice little truck, but again, it doesn't really get much better than much better fuel mileage than the F-150s when you put the V6 in it. And you can get the F-150 for roughly the same price, if not cheaper. It's a great example of kind of Detroit's old think, where small equals cheap, zero profit. Right. Yeah.
Even a couple years ago, they sold the Ranger with the Vulcan 3-liter, the two-valve 3-liter V6, had like 155 horsepower. And now the base 2.5 on an Escape's pulling 170 horsepower, and you know the Escape 2.5 is going to kill the Ranger, current powertrains on the Rangers in regards to fuel economy. You just drop that powertrain combination in the Ranger, and you're a hell of a lot better off.
Oh, but the problem with, the Rangers, Ford's not going to spend any money on that platform. It's dead. They need the newer truck, and the Ranger elsewhere is a better product. It looks a little larger, which is more competitive with the Dakota and the Frontier, which is going to be the same truck, seems like, next time around. So we'll see.
The other one, of course, the other truck that's part of that story is this F-100, which we first reported on a few weeks ago. Actually, pickuptruck.com originally got that story, which is the next gen of the F-Series truck platform. They're going to make it so it can be scaled down. So you'll have this mid-sized truck, you have this Global Ranger, and then this mid-sized truck, it's a little bit smaller than an F-150. you know, based on the same platform architecture, and then the F-150s, and of course the Super Duties up top. So Ford, you know, Ford's looking at having a full truck lineup again, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if that, you know, is really what the market demands.
Right. They're going to have to save a lot of weight on the F-100, and they're going to have to. And I know they said smaller powertrains, more efficient. And they're going to have EcoBoost 4 and 6 cylinder engines. It's going to have to get at least 25 miles per gallon on the highway, or it just isn't going to be a viable choice. And the Ranger in 4 cylinder form is going to have to get 30 miles per gallon. I'm interested to see if the Ranger is even going to be body on frame. I don't see a need for it because people don't use the Ranger like the. I mean, if you wanted to haul anything, you'd get an F-100, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and there's those. It sounds, you know, everybody wails and cries that those fuel economy numbers aren't attainable, but they are. You have to make the trade-off, and even with the software calibrations we have today, you have to pick. You have to pick whether you want to be able to drag race Camaros with your pickup truck, which you can right now. They're insanely powerful. Or you have to pick if you want to be able to get decent mileage yet still have the power to haul and the bed, you know, the utility of a bed, and it's going to be one or the other. You can't have both, and I don't see it as a problem. You do a little bit of ratio changes with the transmissions, with the rear ends, and you do some calibration changes on the engine management, you're there.
Well, I think that's kind of where, you know, Ford sees the EcoBoost coming in, you know, sort of giving you the best of both worlds, because, you know, with the smaller displacement engine, first of all, you've cut a lot of weight, you know, going with a 4 instead of a V6, it's going to be lighter. Similarly, you know, V6 versus a V8, it's going to be lighter. And, you know, just in normal driving, you know, when you're not stomping on it, you're going to get better fuel efficiency. And then, you know, when you do need the power, if you've got to tow something, you know, the turbo can come in and give you that extra power.
Yeah.
You know, sort of on demand. So they're kind of looking to get the best of both worlds with that powertrain setup.
And I don't see a problem with a vehicle the size of the current F-150 with a powerful enough 4-cylinder. I mean, it, no problem there.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see the 4 in the F-150, but definitely in the F-100.
Right.
I mean, you know, they showed that Explorer concept this year in Detroit, you know, and said, you know, that the next gen Explorer will probably have, you know, 4 and 6 cylinder EcoBoost engines, and you know, I'm guessing that the F-100 is probably going to be, probably, you know, be roughly the same size as that Explorer, even though it'll be based on the body on frame architecture of the F-150. And then use the same powertrain setup as the next gen Explorer, which will be unibody.
Well, so you mentioned the Explorer, and there's the wild card too. And I think that's the one thing that kind of makes the Ranger stagnant as well, because you've got the Sport Track, which, you know, again, for price parity almost.
Have either of you guys ever actually seen a Sport Track on the road?
Oh yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's dead. Don't even confuse it. But by the time the next generation Explorer comes out, there will be no Sport Track. Not with an F-100 and Ranger replacement. They might call one of them the Sport Track, but it's as it is right now. Unless they put the Ranger on the same platform as the next generation Explorer, which would make it a little bit too big for my opinion. Unless that happens, I don't see it. I don't see any chance in heck of there being any additional Sport Track.
See, that would almost be a return to the Ranger's roots. I mean, or you know, Explorer started off as Bronco 2, which started off as Ranger.
As a Ranger.
So, yeah.
Thus all the flipping over back in the 90s.
Yeah, well, that and Idiots, which we still have.
Yeah, those aren't going away. You know, I heard Congress was looking into curtailing the idiot count, but I don't think they're going to be able to do that like they did with Cafe.
No, they're full of idiots in Congress, too.
they're all like, I don't see any problem.
That's the problem. I mean, you know, they wouldn't recognize the problem.
They're like, idiots vote. Exactly. For me, no less. But, all right, let's go get on to the next story. The Fusion was spied last week running out around town, and it was a little bit of
quite happily.
It looks happy, doesn't it? I mean,
it's grinning. It's got a big ass grin.
It looks
grin.
Like it knows something that we need to know, is what it. It looks like it's like the class smart aleck or something. It's smiling for sure.
It knows something. Not sure what yet, but the new Fusion and the Milan, although, you know, Got to wonder why they're bothering with the Milan. But anyway, the Fusion and Milan and the MKZ are getting a redesign for two. I guess they're going to be classed as 2010 models when they
but
show
right
up.
Right around the corner,
although,
though, right?
We're not going to see them until the end of the year. So they'll probably debut at the LA Auto Show. And then production starts, I think, in December or something like that. So we won't actually see them until the end of the year. And at that point, I believe that they're going to be 2010 models, classed as 2010 models.
So what are we looking at? We're looking at shorter headlamp clusters, maybe, obviously a different grille and bumper cap.
Yeah, basically a revised version, you know, updated version of the three bar grille look, different light clusters. Powertrains are going to be new. You know, it's basically going to be the same. I think the same powertrain setup that we've got in the 09 Escapes.
That's going to be a hybrid now too, right? They're going to have a hybrid version.
Yeah, they're adding a hybrid version to the Fusion and Milan. You're going to have the 2.5 replacing the 2.3 and the upgraded 3-liter V6 replacing the current one. So 240 horsepower in the top models.
Sounds like a good time.
Yeah, the hybrid version is going to be real interesting. I mean, you know, when I had an Escape hybrid a year ago, I got 30 miles per gallon out of that thing, and you know, with the upgrades for the 09, you know, you could easily get into the mid 30s, you know, with a sedan like the Fusion, as opposed to the more upright shape of the Escape.
Especially with two-wheel drive instead of you know, the available all-wheel drive that. Both, well, I guess both of them have available all-wheel drive, so...
Yeah, the one that I had was a two-wheel drive, was a front-wheel drive when I had the Escape Hybrid. But, you know, just the shape of the Escape Hybrid, you know, is not particularly conducive to fuel economy.
It's flying brick. You can't get better than that.
it's a little bit upright. That's
it's got the big slats yeah. in the front. I mean, that's two-thirds of a mile true. Per gallon. I mean, how much better can a brick right. get yeah. than holes in the bottom?
That's right. And, you know, as it ages and rusts at the firewall, the air will just pass right through and out the rusty tailgate. You'll be all set.
Seriously, cars don't rust anymore, Dan.
What are you trying to say about the Escape, Dan?
They don't rust anymore.
I like the Escape. No, cars don't really rust like they used to.
And yeah, we get rid of them first nowadays, and that's good. All right, let's go on to the last story because we're running a little heavy on time. The last one is the Cerberus report that came out recently, well, it was today, but by the time everybody hears this, it'll be probably yesterday. All kinds of confusion today. The report said that Cerberus sold more than half of its stake in GMAC and Chrysler, and it just clearly wasn't the case. But, I mean, just the topsy-turvy, crazy deal where, you know, 1 minute, Cerberus made $1 billion basically as a gift from the 91 investors for doing a good job. I mean, really, I know Chrysler came out with a statement that it doesn't make any more sense than the story, really, and I don't think anybody really knows exactly what went on unless Sam does.
I have no idea what's going on inside of Chrysler right now. Uh-huh.
It's the broader, in the broader sense of the term as well, right?
Yeah, that's true as well, yes.
I'm just fascinated by the Yugio card that they put on the post. That's excellent.
That was awfully creative by Mr. Neff right there.
Yes. I wonder if it's a scan of his personal collection.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the Cerberus statement right now on the Chrysler media site, and it says Cerberus has not reduced or made any changes to its equity stakes in GMAC or Chrysler since the closing of either transaction. Cerberus continues to have voting control over both investments. You know, it's possible. I mean, you know, the story that I had heard, you know, is they had sold that chunk to, you know, 90 investors, and the implication was that the investors that they sold to were investors who are investors in Cerberus. You know, Cerberus is a private equity fund, and you know the way those work. You know, investors put money into a private equity fund, and then the fund managers go out and buy up companies. Right. You know, with this money,
which and gives them the control of the companies.
Right, and the impression that I had when I first heard this story earlier today was that that Cerberus, the Cerberus fund, had sold some of that stake to some of those investors in Cerberus. You know, so it's just sort of shifting things around. It's still the same people owning it, but you know, just sort of juggling the way the books are. Yeah, you know, from the statement, you know, from Chrysler, it sounds. Well, who knows what's going on?
Well, it says that the last sentence, which after reading exactly what you read, it says, as a general rule, Cerberus does not commit more than 5% of the capital of any of its funds to any single investment. Well, great. I don't know what that means either. So, I mean...
We're not
well, that, that just though. That just means that however much money has been put into Cerberus by its investors, they don't put more than 5% of that into any company that they buy.
So that means that, investors
if they've put a... If the outside investors have put $100 billion into Cerberus, they wouldn't put more than $5 billion into Chrysler or any other company that they
bought.
I guess
it makes sense when you're thinking of $100 billion, which is probably the case. Well,
and when you're looking to strip and flip a company, you don't want to put any money into it. Come on.
that's true.
And that's you know what? Where's the Vegas odds on that one? That's all I want to get in on.
Look, here's my prediction for 2009. We're going to see a major airline fail, and we're going to see a major automaker, U.S. automaker, fail.
Only one?
We'll start with one. You know, unlike the airline business, though, if a major U.S. automaker fails, it's going to be bad. You know, there's enough in in airlines where if one drops out, it'll be bad, but the others will. All improve.
That's exactly. Exactly. And if Chrysler were to fail, Ford and GM would reap nearly zero benefit.
It would be very bad because of the way automakers, it's not just automakers, it's OEMs, it's all of the tertiary businesses that go around the car business. It would be hugely bad.
That's the problem, you know, when you look at the potential for automakers failing, you know, there's a real cascading effect because, you know, especially over the last 20, 30 years, automakers have put more and more of the responsibility for the components that go into the cars in the hands of suppliers, which, you know, when suppliers get into trouble like they have frequently in recent years, like Plastec recently, and you know, a lot of other companies, you know, then the automakers get in trouble. You know, the same thing goes the other way. If the automakers fail, you know, then all the suppliers that sell parts to them are also in trouble, you know, because most of them, you know, if they're making money at all, are running extremely tight margins. I mean, most of the major suppliers are making little, if any, money. And, you know, at best, I mean, I think the biggest margins that I'm aware of for any automotive suppliers are maybe, you know, 5 or 6%,
yeah,
you know, gross margins, which is not much.
Which has been pretty much eroded by the increase in energy costs, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I mean that's eaten into a lot of it. You know, the one place where some suppliers have kind of gotten a little lucky is, you know, some companies that are doing business in Europe in addition to the U.S. Like, you know, for example, TRW. Which, for the sake of disclosure, I used to work for TRW. Reaped a huge benefit at the end of their 2007 results from the exchange rates because they do a little more than half their business with European automakers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the European automakers pay them in euros. And when they converted that to dollars, because TRW is a US-based company, you know, they had a huge, huge extra bonus from that. But, you know, some of the smaller suppliers that don't necessarily do a lot of work in Europe or in other overseas markets are really feeling the pain from, you know, raw material costs, you know, fuel costs, energy costs. So it's a tough business to be in, and it's just going to get tougher.
Well, they need to convert their money to loonies and demand that they get paid in Canadian currency because it's worth, you know?
Or euros.
Yeah, well,
just,
or euros.
Just do all their business in euros.
Yeah, but no, that's my prediction for 2009. We're going to see an automaker really, really hit the skids, as well as an airline.
That's very depressing, real, Dan. Thank you very much.
Well-informed analysis, because you know that's the business I work in, so I know what I'm talking about. Apparently,
yeah, right. Hey, you know what? Just before we go, just out of curiosity,
Or at least you claim you do.
No, nobody knows what he really sarcasm. Does. That's extreme sarcasm, believe
nobody
me.
Nobody knows what he really does, trust me, including the people that pay him. But let's go one last thing before we go, and this is just straight out of my curiosity. Fuel economy right now, the fuel price is over $4 a gallon right now. I'm starting to see it come down. Just wild guesses. By the end of July, what do you guys think the gas will cost?
$4.75.
Yeah. You know,
$4.75,
what?
Maybe $5.
You, really, you don't
yeah,
really
I was
think
say,
that, do you?
Between,
yeah,
okay,
I do.
What do you think, Dan?
I would say $4.50 at least. And you know, my question is, do you like the high energy prices, or do you dislike the high energy prices?
I like them for the same reasons you do, and I think it's going to really stir up some serious change in the auto industry, which will be fun for us to cover, and it'll be fun to see. I mean, firsthand, it'll be exciting. My thought is, for the short term, they're going to go down. That's just my.
They may go down a little, but they're not going to go down.
My wild guess is they're going to go down to $3.30 by the end of July. That's just my guess.
I see.
It's just my guess. Your crazy $4.50 and Sam's $4.75 are just guesses. I mean, we don't base that on a whole lot. That's my guess.
Well, I mean, I think we'll see a reduction by before the end of the year. Possibly, they may dip down to the three something range again. But I think they're going to go up over $4 for the summer.
On the other hand, if George Soros is right, you know, then the oil prices might just collapse entirely. Of course.
Well, that happened in the 80s.
Here's the deal.
Yeah.
Whoever's the closest, I'm at 350. The other two have to buy a Slurpee. Fair enough.
you got it, Chris.
Fair enough.
Okay.
All right.
This sounds
right.
good to
hey,
me.
We didn't have any emails this week because none of you guys out there sent us any emails.
Well,
so.
You know what it is? Yeah. You guys had the wrong team last week. It's all Nunez.
Hey, so, you know, if anybody that's listening to this has any questions, any comments, you know, send them to podcast@autoblog.com. You know, we look forward to hearing from you guys and, you know, hearing what you have to say and, you know, and giving us some topics to talk about. And don't forget to stay subscribed to the podcast on
the new
iTunes.
Weekly podcast, folks. This is weekly.
Yes, it absolutely is weekly now. We will be coming at you every week, come hell or high water.
You know what I would like to see, actually, if listeners want to take this on, we've got Podcast 100 coming up. And if there's some way to kind of mark that milestone, because we haven't thought of anything other than, like, cupcakes, and that's really... not practical.
And we don't, because we're all scattered all over the place, we'd all have to get our own cupcakes.
Yeah, and if Nef did the cupcakes, there'd be no eggs in them because he's a vegan. So
right,
that's just
be,
all the way
around, right.
It's a bad deal.
Look, man, cupcakes made with applesauce, not good.
Think for yourself. All right, guys, let's get out of here since we're at the 1 hour mark.
All right. We'll see you next week.
All right. Bye.
All right, bye.